that out-of-body hallucinations or hearing voices may have generated our sense of the divine. In the past, particularly in Western cultures, there has been a tendency to view hallucinations as a sign of mental malfunction. Yet in recent years, episodes like those experienced by Ujjayi have forced scientists to rethink their ideas of hallucinations as purely a symptom of mental illness or the result of mind-altering drugs. They have begun to realise that hallucinations are neither uncommon nor always a sign of ill health. One person who knows a great deal about this is Sylvia, a retired maths teacher from North London. Despite being incredibly sharp with excellent mental health, Sylvia has experienced a permanent hallucination every day of her life for the past decade. One morning in midwinter, I went to meet her to find out more about this strange phenomenon. In learning more about her life, I came across the most startling discovery of my journey so far. I found that hallucinations are not only common, but vital to producing our perception of reality. So vital, in fact, that you're probably hallucinating right now. It's difficult to imagine what hallucination feels like unless you've experienced one for yourself. I say this with some degree of conviction because a few months ago, early in the morning and alone in bed, I was woken by two strangers entering my room. I was paralysed with fear. I felt wide awake, yet I couldn't move my body. One of the strangers, a man, walked to the opposite side of the room, while the other, a woman, sat down at the bottom of my bed. As she did so, I felt the covers brush across my legs. Later, I discovered that I had been experiencing what's known as a hypnopompic hallucination. They appeared during the transitory period between a sleeping state and wakefulness, and probably occurred due to certain parts of the brain remaining in REM sleep, the period in which we dream the most, while other areas become fully conscious. For me, it had a distinct feeling of objective reality. It was far closer to the experience of someone actually being in the room than the experience of dreaming they were there. This distinction is supported by some evidence. In 1998, Dominic Fitch, a senior lecturer in old age psychiatry, and his colleagues at King's College London, scanned the brains of people experiencing visual hallucinations. They found that the areas of the brain that were active are also active while viewing a real version of the hallucinated image. Those who hallucinated faces, for example, activated areas of the fusiform gyrus, known to contain specialised face recognition cells, active when we look at real faces. The same was true with hallucinations of colour and written words. When the team asked the participants to imagine faces or colours and words, there was nowhere near as much activity in the corresponding areas of the brain. It was the first objective evidence that hallucinations were less like imagination and more like real perception. As well as hypnopompic hallucinations like I experienced, another common hallucination is seeing shapes or hearing sounds as you drift off to sleep at night, or seeing visions of loved ones during a period of grieving. But the kind of hallucination that I am most intrigued about, and the one that reveals most about the brain, is that which crops up in people who have recently lost a sense. Several years ago, my mum called me to tell me that my grandmother had started seeing people. 87 years old, she began to hallucinate after her already poor sight got worse due to cataracts. Her first visitors were women in Victorian dress, shortly followed by young children who danced around her bedroom. Sometimes all she saw was a plain brick wall. My nan was not, it seemed, bothered by these hallucinations. She knew they weren't real, despite their vividness, but was intrigued by what they meant. She was experiencing a common condition in those with failing sight called Charles Bonnet syndrome. Bonnet, a Swiss scientist born in 1720, became interested in hallucinations when his grandfather started to experience visions soon after his eyesight began to fail. One day, his grandfather was sitting in an armchair talking to his two granddaughters. Suddenly, two men appeared. They were, by all accounts, wearing magnificent cloaks of red and grey with hats trimmed with silver. When he asked his grandchildren why no one had told him they would be coming, the elder Bonnet discovered that only he could see them. Over the next month, his visions appeared on many occasions. Sometimes they were further beautiful visitors. Other times they were pigeons or butterflies. Sometimes simply oversized carriages. Bonnet's grandfather apparently enjoyed what he referred to as the theatre in his mind, watching these apparitions for several months before they disappeared completely. Bonnet later experienced the same condition when he too lost his sight in old age. It was a similar story for Max, a man I interviewed for the BBC in 2014. Max was in his 70s when Parkinson's disease destroyed the nerves that send information from the nose to the brain. Despite his loss of scent, one day he suddenly noticed the smell of burning leaves. He was on holiday at the time and so glanced around his hotel room, wondering what could have caused the strange aroma. He was convinced there was a family of skunks around. "It was so strong," he said. "It gave me this strange sensation in my throat that I couldn't get away from." Over the next few weeks, the aromas intensified, ranging from burnt wood to a horrible onion-like stench. They stuck around after he returned home too, sometimes persisting for hours. "When they're at the most intense, they can smell like excrement. It's so powerful it makes my eyes water." Sensory loss doesn't have to be permanent to bring on such hallucinations. Avinash, after all, was in fine health when trekking across the glacier. "I knew I wasn't sick," he told me. "My heart rate was fine. I wasn't dehydrated and I'd had enough food. I tried to rationalise it all. I pinched myself. I kept trying to make sure I wasn't asleep or dreaming. At one point, I tripped and cut my hand. The sight of blood made me sure it wasn't a dream." At one point, he started hearing a voice and felt like there was a presence guiding his every move. "I felt as if it was talking me through things. It was asking me to think carefully, to pick my way through each glacier. It was helping me, guiding me towards where I should be." The whole experience lasted almost 9 hours. I asked myself at one point, "Am I dead? This was a difficult trek. You could have just fallen into a crevice and died and no one would have ever found you. It was only when I passed someone else on the mountain that I knew I was definitely alive. But even when I met up with the rest of my group, I still felt strange. It was only after a good night's sleep that everything went back to normal." Searching for answers to his weird hallucinations, Avinash momentarily wondered whether he had achieved the Sakikalpa Samadhi, a state said to be reached by meditation in Buddhist or Hindu tradition, through which one is said to lose all human consciousness, and in which the conception of time and space is altered. It turns out the answer is far simpler. But to understand more, I needed to speak to Sylvia. One Friday morning in 2004, the people of Potter's Bar were going about their daily business. Minutes from the centre of town was 60-year-old Sylvia, a retired teacher who was working in her house. All was well apart from one thing, that wretched noise, the two notes that had started playing earlier that morning, which no one else seemed to be able to hear. Sylvia had initially thought the radio must be playing, but a quick search proved that not to be the case. Fairly fearful of the strange new noise, which got louder throughout the day, Sylvia went to bed, hoping it would be gone by morning. She woke up to find the noise was still there. It droned on and on, da-dee-da-dee-da-dee. Over weeks, the notes changed, then developed, and months later finally became full-blown musical hallucinations, tunes that were constantly in the background, sometimes so loud that they drowned out normal conversation. "Please ignore her for a moment," Sylvia says, as she welcomes me into the house. She's talking about the Golden Labrador sitting quietly in the hall. Suki is Sylvia's new hearing dog. "Good girl," she says to the dog. "Now you can go and say hello." Suki bounds over to me and sticks her nose straight into my pocket. "She thinks she may have treats," says Sylvia. "It's always worth a try." Sylvia needs a hearing dog because she is deaf. She finds it difficult to hear speech, and real music sounds awful, distorted by profound hearing loss caused by an ear infection several years earlier. Sylvia's husband, John, waves hello as we walk past the grand piano and through to a bright conservatory at the back of the house. I sit down on a wicker chair while Sylvia serves up tea and biscuits. She takes me back to the Friday morning that it all started. She'd had tinnitus and hissing for a number of years previously. But this was something new. It was the notes C and D going back and forth, she says. It was very slow at first. I remember thinking, "Oh, I don't want that. Think about something else." The notes grew from there. I've never had quiet since. Gradually over weeks, the notes developed into short phrases that would repeat over and over again. Sometimes they would get longer, forming complete melodies from the music she had loved before she lost her hearing. "What kind of tunes do you hear most often?" I ask. "It's mostly classical music, short excerpts. When I could hear properly, I didn't tend to listen to much else. Even as we sit talking, through the help of a microphone and lip-reading, Sylvia's tunes are playing in her head. If they ever recede, which they sometimes do when she's focused on a piece of music or concentrating on speaking, they are replaced by a constant B-flat tone and the hiss of tinnitus. Do they resemble any particular instrument, I ask. They're a cross between a wooden flute and a bell, she says. It's really strange. You'd expect to hear a sound that you recognise, maybe a piano or a trumpet, but it's not like anything I know in real life. But it sounds like a real noise. Yes, it's not as if you imagine a tune in your head. It's like listening to the radio. It manifests as real sound. Soon after her hallucinations started, Sylvia did something very constructive. She wrote them down, keeping a record in a manuscript book of all the tunes that would come and go. She has the rare talent of perfect pitch, which allows her to hear any note and know exactly which note is being played. She brings the sheet music to the conservatory for me to read. Some of the pieces are made up of random notes, never going anywhere in particular. Other hallucinations resemble short sections of recognisable tunes. I spot a passage from the traditional Scottish folk song, My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean. Seeing her hallucinations on paper highlights their repetitiveness. There are pages of notes that wind up and down, up and down. They are like this for most of the day, Sylvia says. Years of teaching maths allows her to make a quick mental calculation. If it's just two or three notes, then they can take a second to play before they repeat, she says. So what's that? Hearing the same tiny tune about 86,000 times a day? Sylvia tells me that early on in the evolution of her hallucinations, words began to put themselves to the tunes. I did my utmost to prevent that from happening, she says, and I managed to make it stop. I ask her why. I didn't want that happening. I didn't want words coming into my mind. It just felt a bit too close to schizophrenia. She's right, of course. Hearing voices that are not there is often considered a sign of mental illness. No one knows this better than David Rosenhan, an emeritus professor at Stanford, who in 1973 got himself and seven other completely healthy friends admitted to the mental ward of hospitals across the US. The point of his experiment was to question the validity of psychiatric diagnosis, but they hadn't expected it to be so easy. Rosenhan and his colleagues each phoned a hospital complaining of hearing voices. The rest of their medical history and any other life stories were all true. All eight were admitted. Seven were diagnosed with schizophrenia, one with manic depressive psychosis. As soon as they entered the hospital, they said their hallucinations had disappeared. It was then up to each individual to convince the staff to discharge them, a task that took between 7 and 52 days. In fact, most hallucinations are not associated with schizophrenia. When John McGrath, a professor at the Queensland Brain Institute in Australia, analysed interviews with more than 31,000 people from 18 different countries, he discovered that hallucinations were fairly common in all age groups. When participants were asked whether they had ever experienced a hallucination, such as hearing voices that other people said did not exist, 5% of men and 6.6% of women answered yes. I asked Sylvia whether she tells other people about her hallucinations. No, I don't talk to many people about it. Very early on, I was taught that as sound travels up to the brain, it picks up emotions that go with that sound. In other words, if I became constantly irritated by them, the sounds would always cause irritation. If I told them that they were unimportant, they would stay insignificant. So I took a conscious decision to belittle them and not talk to other people about them. I don't want them to garner an importance. It was the best advice I could have been given. It's allowed me to live with them. She smiles. Sometimes I go, oh, shut up, and my friends know what I'm talking about, but they can't possibly put themselves in my shoes. She glances at John as he pops his head into the conservatory. John, bless him, is a real support in every sort of way, but even he has no idea how dramatic this sound is that's going on all the time. It gets in the way of his conversation with me. I mishear what he says so much of the time. Sometimes I think he said something very funny, and he didn't say it at all. He's very understanding, but no one can have any idea what this is like unless they've experienced it for themselves. In fact, there is a way that you can experience something similar for yourself, safely at home. All you need is a table tennis ball, some headphones, and a bit of tape. Cut the ball in half and tape each segment over your eyes. Sit in a room that is evenly lit. Find some white noise to listen to over your headphones. Sit back and relax. Called the Ganzfeld technique, this kind of sensory deprivation has been used to investigate the appearance of hallucinations for decades. In a paper published in the journal Cortex, Juri Wackermann at the Institute for Frontier Areas of Psychology and Mental Health in Freiburg, Germany, describes some of the hallucinations that occurred in volunteers trying out the technique. For quite a long time, there was nothing except a green, greyish fog, said one participant. It was really boring. I thought, what a nonsense experiment. Then, for an indefinite period of time, I was off, like completely absent-minded. Then all of a sudden, I saw a hand holding a piece of chalk and writing on a blackboard something like a mathematical formula. The vision was very clear, but it stayed only for a few seconds and disappeared again. It was like a window into that foggy stuff. Later, she saw a clearing in a forest and a woman who passed by on a bike, her long blonde hair waving in the wind. Another participant felt like she and a friend were inside a cave. We made a fire. There was a creek flowing under our feet, and we were on a stone. She had fallen into the creek, and she had to wait to have her things dried. Then she said to me, "Hey, move on, we should go now." As I sit back in my own living room, ping-pong balls strapped to my face, I feel much the same way as the first participant. Nothing happened for at least 30 minutes, other than a myriad of random thoughts and waves of sleep. Just as I was wondering whether I should give up, I saw an image coming out from what seemed like a window full of smoke. It was of a man lying curled up next to me. He bent his elbow in this strange way, as if presenting it to me. It appeared for a few seconds, then disappeared. It certainly differed from a dream, or from a random image plucked from my imagination. It was an intriguing demonstration of what can occur when our senses are impaired. But why does it happen? The brain doesn't tolerate inactivity, said Oliver Sacks when I spoke to him about this back in 2014. It seems to respond to diminished sensory input by creating autonomous sensations of its own choosing. This was noted soon after the Second World War, he said, when it was discovered that high-flying aviators in featureless skies and truck drivers on long, empty roads were prone to hallucinations. Now researchers believe that these unreal experiences provide a glimpse into the way our brains stitch together our perception of reality. Although bombarded with thousands of sensations every second of the day, your brain rarely stops providing you with a steady stream of consciousness. Think about all the sounds, smells, and tactile sensations that you can sense right now. Noise from the outside world, the tightness of your socks, the feel of a book against your fingers. Processing everything that you experience in the world all of the time would be a very inefficient way to run a brain. So instead, it takes a few shortcuts. Let's use sound as an example. When sound waves enter the ear, they are converted into electrical messages by receptors within the ear canal and transmitted to the brain's primary auditory cortex. This part of the brain processes the rawest elements of sound, such as patterns and pitch. From here, the signals get passed onto higher brain areas that process more complex features, such as melody, key changes, and emotional context. Instead of relaying every detail up the chain of command, the brain combines the noisy signals coming in with prior experiences to generate a prediction of what's happening in the world. If you hear the opening notes to a familiar tune, for instance, you expect the rest of the song to follow. That prediction is passed back to the lower regions, where it is compared to the actual input, and to the frontal lobes, which perform a kind of reality check, before it pops up in our consciousness. Only if a prediction is wrong does a signal get passed back to higher areas, which adjust subsequent predictions. You can test this for yourself. Anil Seth, a cognitive and computational neuroscientist at the University of Sussex, suggests listening to sine wave speech, a degraded version of a speech recording. The first time, all you'll hear is a jumble of beeps and whistles. But if you listen to the original recording and then switch back to the degraded version, you will suddenly be able to make out what is being said. All that has changed is your brain's expectations of the input. It means it now has better information on which to base its prediction. Our reality, Seth once told me, is merely a controlled hallucination, reined in by our senses. or, as psychologist Chris Frith once put it, a fantasy that coincides with the reality. This idea is consistent with what was happening to Sylvia. Although her regular hearing is distorted, familiar music can sometimes suppress her hallucinations for brief periods. In 2014, Timothy Griffiths thought he might be able to use this to support the prediction model of hallucinations. The main obstacle to studying hallucinations and why they arise has always been an inability to control them. Sylvia gave us a chance to switch them on and off, he says. Griffiths and his colleagues had Sylvia come into their lab and lie down in a machine that analysed her brainwaves, the cyclic flow of electrical activity around the brain. While the machine was analysing her brain activity, Griffiths' team played Sylvia various passages from her familiar Bach concerto. Sylvia rated the intensity of her hallucinations every 15 seconds throughout the study. At the time of the experiment, her musical hallucinations happened to consist of sequences from Gilbert and Sullivan's musical HMS Pinafore. Immediately following the bark, her hallucinations were silent for a few seconds, gradually increasing in volume until the start of the next excerpt. It was this that allowed Griffiths to measure her brain activity without the hallucinations and then with them. Sylvia's brain scan showed that during her hallucinations, regions of the brain that process melodies and sequences of tones were talking to one another, just as they might if she was listening to real music. Yet, because Sylvia is severely deaf, they were not constrained by the real sounds entering her ears. Her hallucinations are her brain's best guess at what is out there. This theory also explains why listening to some kinds of music can stop Sylvia's hallucinations. When she is concentrating on Bach, something she is familiar with, the signal entering her brain is much more reliable, and that constrains the aberrant conversation going on in higher areas. This then reconciles itself to what is actually happening in the real world. This notion of hallucinations as errant predictions has also been put to the test in completely silent rooms known as anechoic chambers. At Orfield Laboratories in Minneapolis, Minnesota, you can find such a chamber, dubbed the quietest place on Earth. The chamber is actually a pitch-black room, built inside a room, built inside another room. It has 3-foot-thick walls of steel and concrete, and is lined with jagged padding designed to absorb what's left of any tiny sound. Once inside, you can hear your eyeballs moving and your skin stretching across your skull. People generally start to hallucinate within 20 minutes of the door closing. But what's the trigger? I asked Oliver Mason, a clinical psychologist at University College London, who specialises in sensory deprivation. There are two possibilities, he said. One is that sensory regions of the brain occasionally show spontaneous activity that is usually suppressed and corrected by real sensory data coming in from the world. In the deathly silence of an anechoic chamber, under the influence of the Ganzfeld technique, or in the case of a permanent lost sense, the brain may make predictions based on this spontaneous activity that then run riot. The second possibility is that the brain misinterprets internally generated sounds. In an anechoic chamber, for instance, the sound of blood flowing through your ears isn't familiar, so it could be misattributed as coming from outside you. Once a sound is given significance, you've got a seed, said Mason, a starting point on which a hallucination can be built. Not everyone reacts in the same way inside an anechoic chamber. Some people don't hallucinate at all. Others do, but realise it was their mind playing tricks. Some people come out and say, I'm convinced you were playing noises in there, says Mason. This was something I was puzzled about. Why did Sylvia hear hallucinations when others with hearing loss did not? When I asked Mason about this, he told me there were several theories. Finding out the answer is incredibly important, he said, because it could reveal why some people are more prone to the delusions and hallucinations associated with mental illness. We know that electrical messages passed across the brain are either excitatory or inhibitory, meaning they either promote or impede activity in neighbouring neurons. In a recent unpublished experiment, Mason's team analysed the brain activity of volunteers while they sat in an anechoic chamber for 25 minutes. Those who had more hallucinatory sensations had lower levels of inhibitory activity across their brain. Perhaps, says Mason, weaker inhibition makes it more likely that irrelevant signals suddenly become meaningful. People with schizophrenia often have overactivity in their sensory cortices, but poor connectivity from these areas to their frontal lobes. This might mean that the brain makes lots of predictions that are not given a reality check before they pass into conscious awareness, says Flavie Waters, a clinical neuroscientist at the University of Western Australia in Perth. In conditions like Charles Bonnet syndrome, it is underactivity in the sensory cortices that triggers the brain to start filling in the gaps, and there is no actual sensory input to help it correct course. In both cases, says Waters, the brain starts listening in on itself instead of tuning into the outside world. This kind of research is helping people like Max, who can spend whole days surrounded by strange smells, reconnect with the external world. If his smell hallucinations are driven by a lack of reliable information, then real smells should help him to suppress the hallucinations. He has been trialling sniffing three different scents 3 times a day. Maybe it's just wishful thinking, he says, but it seems to be helping. The knowledge that hallucinations can be a byproduct of how we construct reality might change how we experience them. In his later years, Sax himself became blind in one eye and had severe vision loss in the other. When he played the piano, he noticed that he would occasionally see showers of flats when he was looking carefully at musical scores. "Why they are flats, not sharps, I don't know," he said. He also hallucinated letters and the occasional words. His hallucinations didn't bother him, he told me. I have long since learned to ignore them, and occasionally enjoy them. I like seeing what my brain is up to when it is at play. Recently, Sylvia's musical hallucinations have become much quicker, so that the notes go at a faster pace. They've also become louder. Now, she says, her hallucinations have developed so much that if she practices a Mozart sonata on the piano and then stops, the whole of the first movement will play in her mind. She says it's like having one's own internal iPod. It has its downsides. December can become a nightmare for Sylvia. There'll be carols in all the supermarkets, so I'll get fragments of those playing over and over. It will drive me mad. Interestingly, words have also started to influence her hallucinations. The previous day, Sylvia had been reading and the word abide was on the page. Suddenly the hymn, Abide With Me, had started to play on Sylvia's internal iPod. Images can also trigger songs. When she was in a toy shop with her granddaughter, she caught sight of a jester with bells hanging off its hat. Suddenly, When That I Was and a Little Tiny Boy started playing, the jester song from Twelfth Night. She says that she has also begun to get a modicum of control over her hallucinations. That morning, for example, she had gone swimming. The wax earplugs make everything silent, which renders the tunes in her head even more obvious. It was going, yada da bom bom, yada da bom bom, she says. I didn't want that going on all the time I was swimming, so I pitched out loud a note that was a semitone up from what was playing to conflict with it. This made the tune hesitate. It sometimes takes a long time, but I can often make it change. I can also change it by singing another tune that I'd prefer to hear. Sometimes it works, sometimes it won't. Sometimes it changes for a bit and then reverts back to the original annoying few notes. It's like a stubborn child in there saying, no, I want to play this. I ask her if she ever has more than a few seconds of silence. No, never, she replies. Do you ever feel like you can tune into your own private radio and enjoy what you're hearing when it's a tune that you like? Sylvia thinks about this for a while. I've been terribly careful not to let the tunes pick up any emotion so that they don't constantly make me emotional, she says. I mean, they do still make me irritable. Sometimes I feel as if I haven't fully rested when I wake up. Sometimes it's really intrusive when they start playing before you've even found your slippers. But perhaps that's just me being an irritable old woman. But I don't mind it so much when it's a full tune that I recognise. She smiles. I laugh at it a bit. I listen to it. I marvel at it. I do my best not to sing to it in case it reinforces it. She pauses. But then it contracts. It always contracts. It might play 2 or 3 times and then it gets shorter and I realise it's only the first 2 pages or the first 2 lines of the tune and eventually just 2 or 3 notes again. That's the point when you can truly imagine being driven mad by it. Just da-da-da-da-da, 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 da-da... I leave Sylvia's later that afternoon, amazed by her control, resilience and good humour over what could easily have become a soul-destroying condition. Society teaches us to be fearful of those things that are not present in the world, to associate seeing and hearing things that no one else does as a sign of mental unrest. Sylvia, Avinash, Max, even my own Nan, prove that this need not be true. We shouldn't be afraid to fight this misunderstanding, to speak out when we experience things a little unusual. It is possible that we are all hallucinating all of the time. Some of us are just more aware of it than others. Chapter 6. Matar, Turning into a Tiger. Throughout history, there have been legends of men who could turn into animals and then back into human form. The most feared of all is the werewolf, a bloodthirsty creature beset by murderous urges, devouring both the living and the dead. This man-to-beast story has appeared in almost every period of human history, from our earliest popular fiction, Satyricon, to the Roman tales of Lycaon, the cruel leader of Arcadia, who was transformed into a wolf as punishment for trying to kill Jupiter, god of the sky. Today we only have to turn the pages of Harry Potter and the Twilight Saga to see that the werewolf's tale has lost none of its gory appeal. You may wonder where werewolves fit into my quest to meet people with the world's strangest brains. But the extraordinary truth of it is, werewolves aren't restricted to popular fiction and folklore. There are references to people turning into animals in some of our earliest medical texts. Paulus Aegineta, an Alexandrian physician in the 7th century, described the affliction as something suffered by people with melancholy or an excess of black bile. Increasingly over the medieval period, it was interpreted as the work of magic and the devil. The result was a person who was said to be prone to beast-like howls, who would seek out raw meat and attack other humans. What could have caused such an affliction? One possibility is that ointments prescribed at the time for other illnesses could have led to side effects akin to chronic pins and needles. This may have been interpreted as the feeling of hair growing inside the skin and proof of a person turning into an animal. Historians have also suggested that ingestion of medicinal plants such as poppies or henbane, a plant similar to toxic belladonna, might have been to blame. 17th century herbalists used henbane as a sedative and as a cure for rheumatic pain and toothache. We now know that these treatments can produce vivid hallucinations. There are extensive accounts of people feeling like they've been temporarily transformed into leopards, snakes, and mythological animals after ingesting such plants. Over time, several cures were considered, including drinking vinegar, purging the body of blood, and most drastic of all, being shot with a silver bullet. One of the most famous werewolf accounts is that of 14-year-old Jean Grenier from Lelan, France. In the early 17th century, Grenier boasted of having eaten more than 50 children. He said he preferred to run around on all fours and felt cravings for raw flesh, especially that of little girls, which he claimed is delicious. Grenier was sentenced to be hanged and his body burned. However, before this could happen, the local council sent two doctors to examine him. They decided he was suffering from a malady called lycanthropy, induced by an evil spirit which deceived men's eyes into imagining such things. Rather than face execution, Grenier was sent to a monastery. It wasn't until the mid-19th century that a completely rational explanation prevailed, with physicians concluding that the condition was not mystical in nature, but a form of mental illness. In the past century, what is now known as clinical lycanthropy has been given a broader definition, encompassing the delusion of having turned into any animal. There have been reports of people thinking they have turned into dogs, snakes, a hyena, and even a bee. It is incredibly rare. When Jan Dirk Blom, a psychiatrist at the Parnasia Psychiatric Institute in the Netherlands, searched through international records, he found just 13 verified reports of people with the delusion of turning into a wolf in the previous 162 years. I was intrigued, but somewhat disturbed by this unusual disorder. Sharon and Reuben had shown me how easily one person's perception of the world can differ from another's, and Sylvia had opened my eyes to the hallucinations that we can all experience, but this felt so much more extreme. How can our brain be so dismissive of our human form? How can a person be convinced that they possess not arms and legs, but claws or wings? What is it like, I wondered, to look into the mirror and see an animal staring back? And could it tell us anything about the way we think about our own bodies? As Blom discovered, cases are few and far between, so I didn't expect to be able to meet anyone who had suffered from clinical lycanthropy. Nevertheless, I have been regularly checking in with specialist physicians and psychiatrists to see whether they knew of anyone who'd had the disorder. It quickly became apparent that clinical lycanthropy is not a condition in its own right, but appears alongside other more common mental illnesses such as schizophrenia. Most doctors I spoke to said they had never come across it. One man that had was Hamdi Mosseli, chair of the College of Medicine and Health Sciences at the United Arab Emirates University. In fact, he is one of the few researchers in the world who has treated the condition more than once. Hamdi's first encounter with clinical lycanthropy was back in the early 1990s, while working as a registrar at All Saints Hospital in Birmingham, England. There he met a 36-year-old man who had been behaving strangely for several years, ever since being arrested for wandering into the path of an oncoming car. His patient had been crawling on the floor, barking and eating vomit from the streets. He told doctors that he believed he was a dog and heard voices telling him to do things that a dog would do, like drink water from the toilet. "I'd never heard of this phenomenon in psychiatry," said Hamdi when I first spoke to him about it. "I thought he might be pretending to feel this way in order to get away from a crime." He talked to his supervisor, who told him to go and read up on lycanthropy. Keen to learn from past cases, Hamdi scoured the medical literature. He discovered a description of a 34-year-old woman who came to the emergency department agitated and tense. Suddenly, she started jumping around like a frog, croaking and darting out her tongue as if to catch a fly. Another case study described a woman who had the strange feeling that she was becoming a bee. She felt she was getting smaller and smaller. Late in 2015, Hamdi emailed me to say that he had a patient called Matar who had suffered from lycanthropy on and off for years. For hours on end, he would be convinced he had turned into a tiger. Now, though, he had his condition under control and was happy to talk to me about it. "Would you like to come to Abu Dhabi and meet him?" It is 9 o'clock in the morning, and already the thermometer in the car is creeping up to 44 degrees Celsius. From the comfort of my air-conditioned taxi, I watch the gleaming skyscrapers flash by my window. The gigantic brown and gold turrets of the Sheikh Zayed Grand Mosque, the largest in the United Arab Emirates, stand on the horizon. We travel west until we reach the outskirts of the city, where the grand buildings disintegrate into tiny rows of run-down shops. As we turn onto a 5-lane highway lined with palm trees, quite suddenly the buildings disappear, as if we've reached some invisible border. The view on either side becomes a barren mix of desert dunes, the odd tree, and an occasional sign for a distant camel racetrack. The scenery stays this way for an hour. "The people of Al Ain are pure local village people," my driver Amjad says suddenly, waking me from my dune-induced trance. I look around and notice that the side of the road has become a little greener. Its community may think of themselves as village people, but Al Ain is in fact the UAE's fourth biggest city, situated close to the border of Oman. It is sometimes known as the Garden City, a reflection of its numerous parks and tree-lined avenues. Down one of these avenues is Al Ain Hospital, where Amjad parks and I jump out. The hot air hits me like the opening of an oven, and so I walk quickly towards the nearest air-conditioned building. There I am met by Hamdi and Rafia Rahim, a softly spoken and fiercely intelligent specialist physician. As the three of us head back into the main hospital, I ask Rafia if Matar is well. "He is fine," she says, "but he has been a little anxious this morning." Matar is sitting in a chair at the side of a wide, busy corridor. He is wearing a traditional kandura, a long white shirt-like garment, and a white headdress. He is in his mid-40s, but the dark circles under his eyes age him. He has a thick black beard speckled with grey and chubby cheeks that are heavily lined with wrinkles. He gets up from his seat and looks at Hamdi, who greets him warmly. "This is Helen," says Hamdi. I stretch out my hand and Matar shakes it gently. We walk as a group through the hospital to a wing of empty offices. At the end of the corridor is a tiny study containing a single desk and four chairs. Hamdi asks us to take a seat while he goes in search of some water. Matar chooses a chair nearest the door, while I sit at right angles to him. Rafia leaves us briefly to check on something in her office. Alone together, I smile at Matar and thank him for coming into the hospital to see me. He stares at me, then tilts his head to the side, looking momentarily puzzled. I ask him how he is. Once again, he gives a little indication that he understands what I am saying. I know that Matar isn't fluent in English, but I was under the impression that he knew a little. I smile and nod at the door. I'll wait for Hamdi. As we sit there in silence, I think back to what I already know about Matar. He was 16 when he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. At the time, he had frequent admissions to the local psychiatry inpatient unit. Once, he had called the police because he believed that the UAE was under attack after experiencing auditory and visual hallucinations of bombs exploding. Based on his call, the army was mobilised. He was later arrested for making false charges. As an adult, Matar told his doctors that alongside his regular hallucinations, he had begun to turn into a tiger at night. He said he felt claws starting to appear from his hands and feet, and that he would roar around the room. When it happened, he would lock himself in his room because he feared that if he went outside, he might eat someone. He had told Hamdi how one day he felt himself turn into a tiger while having his hair cut. He jumped up from the chair and tried to bite the barber. Schizophrenia is often said to be one of the most complex of all human disorders. It affects about 1 in 100 people, and common symptoms include paranoia, hallucinations, disorganized thinking, and lack of motivation. Despite a strong genetic component, people who have immediate family members with schizophrenia have a much higher risk of having the disorder themselves, as well as clear environmental triggers such as trauma and drug use, we still do not know exactly why it occurs. Some of the genetic research points to a mutation on chromosome 22, within a region known to be involved in the development and maturation of neurons. When researchers at the Riken Brain Science Institute in Japan grew neurons from stem cells obtained from people with this mutation, they found that fewer neurons grew, and those that did migrated over shorter distances than from stem cells taken from people without the mutation. It suggests that the mutation could cause abnormal growth and development in the earliest stages of life, which may affect how different neural networks within the brain communicate. With such a wide constellation of symptoms, it has been difficult to pinpoint which neural networks are most affected. However, in recent years, it has been suggested that some symptoms of schizophrenia may arise from disruption to networks that allow us to distinguish between things that are generated by ourselves and things that belong to our external world. We tend to give little thought to this distinction. Most of us instinctively know, for instance, that when we stick out our leg or tell a joke, it is our own leg that's moving and our own words that we can hear. But the reason we are able to come to this conclusion is because our brain can predict the sensory consequences of our own actions, which gives us the feeling of being in control of the things we say and do. Since the late 1980s, Chris Frith at University College London and his colleagues have been developing a model for how this sense of agency arises and how it might explain some of the symptoms of schizophrenia. Let's use your leg as an example. Give it a wiggle. To make this movement, your motor cortex, a region towards the top of the brain, sends messages to the muscles in your leg, instructing them to move back and forth. According to Frith's model, at the same time, a copy of this message gets sent to other areas of the brain, which create a mental representation of the intended movement, a prediction of the consequences of this action. Once your leg wiggles, all the sensations that it creates, from the sight of your leg moving to the sensations that arise from the movement of our skin, tendons and joints, are compared to this prediction. If they match, we gain a sense of agency over the action. These self-generated movements are registered in the brain less acutely than those sensations initiated by someone else. It's a clever adaptation. It means we don't jump out of our skin every time we touch our own arm, as we might if someone else unexpectedly grabs us. In much the same way, when we speak, the brain appears to send a copy of the instruction to move our vocal cords to the auditory cortex. A few hundred milliseconds after we speak, our auditory cortex is dampened down. This doesn't happen when you hear someone else speak. It suggests that the brain predicts what sound you intend to make based on your vocal movements and compares this prediction to incoming sounds. If the two match, the sound is understood as your own and somewhat ignored. But if any part of this system goes awry, perhaps because of poor communication or bad internal timing mechanisms, we can no longer link our intentions with our actions and their predicted consequences. The brain is then forced to produce some other explanation for why these things are happening. In 2016, Anne-Laure Lemaitre and her colleagues at the University of Lille, France, tested the theory that this is what is happening in schizophrenia with a simple experiment that you can try at home. All you have to do is remove your top, stretch your left arm up to the sky, and with your right hand, reach into your armpit and give yourself a little tickle. It probably has zero effect. It's really hard to tickle ourselves. That's because our brain is predicting the consequences of the movements of our right hand and suppressing our reaction to them. The element of expectation and surprise, necessary for a good tickle, is gone. But when Lemaitre tested the ability of people with schizophrenic-like traits to tickle themselves with a feather, she found that they were much more likely to report a ticklish sensation than a non-schizophrenic control group. The results support the theory that people with schizophrenia are less able to predict the sensory consequences of their actions, which may lead to problems differentiating between sensations that arise from themselves and those that are externally produced. We also see disruptions in the mechanisms that help us predict the sound of our own voice in people with schizophrenia, suggesting their brain cannot readily distinguish between internally and externally generated voices. It doesn't take a great leap of imagination to see how these disruptions could lead to a person concluding that they are not in control of their actions, or that an internal monologue is coming not from themselves, but from somewhere else. Hamdi interrupts my thoughts, returning with small pots of water for all of us. He sits down next to me, shortly followed by Rafia, who takes a seat behind the desk. Hamdi acts as translator while I thank Matar for coming to the hospital that day. He hadn't needed an appointment. He lives in a nearby village with his mum and sister and had travelled in alone especially to speak with me. I asked Matar whether he is happy to tell me a bit about his background, where he grew up, whether he has a partner. He thinks about the question for a second or two and begins to speak softly, telling me that he has a wife. But almost immediately he hesitates. I have read that people who have suffered from lycanthropy can often show signs of shyness, so I turn to Hamdi. Please let him know that he doesn't have to answer any questions he doesn't feel comfortable with. Suddenly Matar grimaces, throwing his head back and producing a strange sound. I'm momentarily startled before realising that he is sobbing. He looks up at the ceiling while his shoulders rise up and down. Rafia grabs a box of tissues and slips them across the desk. Matar dries his eyes and apologises. He says the reason he is upset is because he has two children who he no longer sees. One is 14 years old and the other is 8, he thinks. He says he doesn't know exactly because he hasn't seen them properly for a long time. My wife doesn't want me to see them at the moment, he says. They live quite far away. Hamdi turns to me and explains that Matar's wife took their children away after Matar started experiencing symptoms of lycanthropy, believing he might be a danger to them. I nod, trying to present some kind of understanding through my actions, if not my speech. After a few moments, Hamdi asks Matar if he would like to continue with his interview. He says yes, so I ask him how his symptoms began and what they felt like. My schizophrenia started with visual hallucinations, he says. I saw people coming and going that weren't really there. I could feel men and women and children grabbing at my legs and then falling to the floor. His hallucinations grew worse over time. It felt like people were starting to control my speech, that they could read my mind. They weren't allowing me to talk. Suddenly Matar stops and looks at me strangely. He says something to Hamdi and jabs his finger in my direction. I look at Hamdi. He says he's suspicious of you because you're British, he says. Why? Hamdi turns to Matar and asks him to explain his reasoning. We're all talking too much English, says Hamdi. It's making him anxious. The two of them chat for a while in Arabic. At the end of the conversation, Matar seems calm. He says he actually really likes the UK. He tells me that he got a scholarship to study at a British university, but that he needs to learn the language better. He says he'd like to study there one day. He seems more at ease, so I ask him whether he can explain what used to happen when he felt like he was turning into a tiger. Matar thinks for a moment and then points to his head and neck. I feel it in my thoughts and in my body, he says. He rolls up his sleeve and shows me his arm. He pulls at his thick black hairs, making them stand on end. When it starts to happen, all my hairs stand upright. The hair all over my body becomes erect. Then I get a spiky, itchy feeling over my body and my beard. It starts with a pain in my left leg, then it moves to my right leg, then to my arms. I start to feel an electric light sensation going through my body. Then it feels like I want to bite someone. I can't control it. I just know that I'm turning into a tiger. He pauses and touches his throat, then looks directly at me and says something I don't understand in Arabic. I glance at Hamdi, who looks puzzled. Matar says he has that feeling now. All too often, the media are guilty of portraying people with schizophrenia as being violent. In fact, there is little scientific evidence for this at all. When Beth McGinty at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and her colleagues analysed news coverage from 1995 to 2014, they found that 40% of all news stories about mental illness focused on a link between mental illness and violence. That's highly disproportionate to the actual rates of violence among people with mental illness. In the UK, for instance, homicides due to mental disorders peaked in 1973 and then declined to a rate of 0.07 per 100,000 people in 2004, the last year for which data was analysed. That compares to total homicides, which increased over the same period and peaked in 2004 at 1.5 per 100,000 people. It's a dangerous misperception among reporters, the public, and policymakers that mental illness is at the root of violence. Needless to say, sometimes it is. The high-profile assassination attempt on the American politician Gabrielle Giffords, for example, was carried out by Jared Lee Loughner, who was subsequently diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. But most acts of violence are the result not of the hallucinations and paranoia that accompany schizophrenia, but of anger and emotional issues, drug and alcohol use. Most people with mental illness are not violent towards others, and most violence is not caused by mental illness, says McGinty. These thoughts comfort me. I look at Hamdi and Rafia for direction. They both speak to Matar quietly. They tell him to relax, that there is no need to feel anxious in here, that we're all friends. The room is silent for what feels like several minutes. Matar seems to be fighting some kind of internal civil war. Suddenly he grips his legs. Do you feel like you want to attack? Hamdi asks, breaking the silence. Matar looks up at him. How did you know that? Are you reading my mind? Hamdi assures him that he cannot read his mind and that he is just asking how he is feeling. Matar looks at him with suspicion. Then he says something in Arabic that makes Hamdi laugh softly. What's going on? I ask. Matar asks me if I really am the Hamdi he knows. He thinks I might be an imposter. He says the Hamdi he remembers is really fat. Matar nods. The Hamdi I know is obese, he says. I raise an eyebrow at Hamdi. No, he's right, he says, smiling. I haven't seen Matar in person for a year or so, and when I last saw him, I really was obese. Hamdi explains to Matar that he's lost a lot of weight recently, and that surely he recognises both him and Rafia. The Hamdi I knew was more kind, says Matar. Hamdi smiles and chats to Matar for a little while longer. He asks if he wants to stop or carry on. Suddenly Matar's shoulders relax and his eyes become more focused. Yes, let's continue, he says. I take a deep breath and ask Matar what it is about his delusions that make him feel like a tiger, rather than, say, a cat or some other animal. I feel like you are eating my legs, like a Kentucky drumstick, Matar says, ignoring my question. You feel like a lion to me. I want to attack you before you attack me. My gut clenches. There is no getting round it. Matar is clearly in the midst of a terrible relapse. He takes a sudden intake of breath, looks down into his lap, and a deep and incredibly realistic growl rumbles from his mouth. My pen hovers above my notepad, and I find myself imagining what a predator and prey might do in this situation. Handy is sitting on my left and the door is to my right. But I don't want to move. I don't want to startle him. Matar has both hands clenched on the top of his legs and his fingers have begun flexing as if they have claws. The growling is directed at